I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Freedom, justice, honor. A few of the ideals mentioned in times of war when trying to describe what exactly is worth fighting for, dying for. There are other reasons why people fight, of course. Hatred, revenge, religion. If a 20th century filled with bloodshed has given us any lesson for the 21st, perhaps it is that holy war is in the eye of the beholder. In the last few weeks, there have been reports of busloads of young men from around the Gulf picking up arms and traveling to Iraq to fight against coalition forces. We don't know how many of these young volunteers made it inside Iraq, but we do know that something prompted young men in Egypt and Syria and Jordan to leave their countries, their families, their homes, and endanger their lives by picking up arms and answering the call to jihad. It's not their country, not their fight, yet still they come. Connection listeners, what would prompt someone to leave his home to fight a war for someone else's country? Is it Islamic identity, religious fervor, anti-Americanism, or perhaps something even deeper at work here? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guests to explore the meaning of jihad are Stephen Simon, senior analyst for the RAND Corporation, and former senior fellow for U.S. Security Studies at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. He is also the co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror and co-editor of Iraq at the Crossroads, State and Society in the Shadow of Regime Change. Stephen joins us from Washington. Hello, Stephen.
Hi there.
And from the BBC studio in Amman, Muin Rabbani, a Middle East analyst currently based in Jordan. Previously, he directed the Palestinian American Research Center in the West Bank town of Ramallah. Welcome, Muin.
Hello.
Muin, perhaps I can start with you. I wonder if you could give us a little bit of a thumbnail sketch as to who these young men are. Are they mercenaries or are they volunteers who are paying their own way, which I read in at least one account seems to be the code of jihad?
Well, they would describe themselves as volunteers for the simple reason that they did not go to Iraq for payment, as a mercenary would usually do, but went there out of a sense of identification with a struggle that they thought they were waging. They went, I think, for a mixture of religious and nationalist motivation, from their point of view, to defend Iraq as an Arab and Islamic country against invasion by Western and non-Islamic forces. The indications are, you know, they came from all across the Arab and Islamic world, primarily from the surrounding Arab countries, and they appear not to have been organized in the sense of, you know, an organization like Al-Qaeda sending fighters to Iraq. The only organizations that we know that claim to have sent militants to Iraq are the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and which is, of course, an Islamist group, and the Lebanese branch of the Palestinian National Liberation Movement, Fatah, which is a nationalist group, though how many of their fighters they actually succeeded in infiltrating into Iraq is unclear at this time.
Muin, do you have any sense of whether some Arab countries, that this call resonated more than others?
Not really. I think it tended to resonate most in those countries where there were the highest levels of hostility to the war. And that would be countries such as Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, where, you know, the call was much better received than, for example, in a country like Kuwait or Iran.
Stephen, I want to turn to you, and let's talk a little bit about the numbers. We heard from Iraqi officials before the fall of Baghdad that there were some 4,000 to 6,000 volunteers ready to come in and be suicide bombers. Others have said, no, it's really more like hundreds. So what's your sense of that?
Well, I don't really know. You know, a number in the thousands is plausible, but I suspect that getting to Iraq was difficult for many. It's a struggle to exit their own countries and get to a place where they can actually cross a border into Iraq. The logistical, just the practical difficulties probably would have kept the numbers somewhat low. But I suspect as well that the impulse to go and partake in this jihad was fairly widespread and isn't reflected by the number of people who actually managed to get to the border of Iraq.
Were they recruited, as far as you know, Stephen, or was this an individual response to something that they felt they needed to go and do?
I agree with Moeen. I don't think that this was an organized effort. I think this rested very much with individual judgment, individual impulses. There would have been some kind of, esprit generated by mosque preaching and so forth. But in this situation, which is interpreted by many Muslims as an attack on Islam, I mean, many Muslims think that there is an ongoing war against Islam waged by the United States and its allies, and the invasion of Iraq was just the latest example of this effort. And those who hold this view would think that in this state of emergency, as it were, it's the individual responsibility of Muslims to take action, to do what they can to defeat the aggressor.
Moeen, I understand that you heard many of these young men interviewed on television as they were on their way to Iraq. I'd be interested in hearing what they had to say and also how that played in Amman. I mean, were they viewed there as being noble or misguided?
Well, the interesting thing here in Amman is that it was, you know, not only non-Iraqi Arabs and Muslims making their way to Iraq, but also Iraqis themselves. You know, there's a community of several hundred thousand Iraqis here in Jordan. Many of them are, in fact, Shiites and either not supporters of the former Iraqi regime or opposed to it. And then once the war began, and especially after it seemed that Iraq was scoring some initial successes in the south of Iraq, they were kind of overtaken by this wave of nationalism. And hundreds of them, some say thousands, but I suspect it's in the hundreds, began returning to Iraq. And so it was, I think, a phenomenon that enjoyed very widespread popular support.
And in Amman, that's part of where the support came from as well?
Oh, very much so. I think throughout this country there were also reports of tribes within Jordan that may have had links also with tribes across the border in western Iraq that were also going to send fighters to Iraq, though the extent to that which happened, if any, is very difficult to assess at this point.
So it was applauded there. You know, to many Westerners, though, it seems very puzzling, particularly in terms of the Shia. You know, these are people who had been brutally repressed by the Saddam regime for years, for decades. And to Westerners, it seems quite odd to think that they would then go in. So what was this? Was this nationalism or was this anti-Americanism?
I think primarily it was a sense of Iraqi patriotism or Iraqi nationalism, and also quite clearly they were also overtaken by a sense of hostility to the U.S. and the former colonial power in Iraq, Great Britain. Now, you know, the antecedent to this is the Iran-Iraq War, where you also had the Iraqi Shia community, which, as you say, had been brutally repressed by Saddam's regime, on the whole remaining loyal to Iraq and to its government in a war against a power, Iran, which was being ruled by Shiite Islamic clerics.
So country trumped dictator here.
Initially it did, but I think as we've seen more recently within Iraq, it was very much the opposite the regime was overthrown.
Stephen, I'd be curious in your response to a couple of the reports that came out of Iraq. One was from a British newspaper that quoted one of these volunteers who said that he had gone there to be a martyr and to help Iraqis liberate their country, and, quote, all they did was shoot us in the back. And then there was another story from Arab News that told about a bewildered young volunteer who said he had been robbed on his way to Baghdad from the south. And at that point, an Iraqi taxi driver who was listening to the story leaned over and said, "And who told you to come here?"
Yeah. Look, there's no question that idealistic, naive young men far from home, making their way, you know, quickly to what they think will be the place of their, you know, transcendental act of martyrdom, are easy prey for people who are going to fleece them. This is an old story among pilgrims throughout the ages, going to holy sites, or in fact, if you look at the medieval literature on European crusaders going to the Middle East, they were robbed and pillaged and exploited in sort of the same way. So this strikes me as the occupational hazard of the person going off to do a jihad or a crusade. I'm not intimately familiar with battlefield operations within Iraq, but I too have read reports that in some cases the volunteers were pushed to the front and then abandoned, and in some cases forced to fight once they realized that the cause was hopeless and defeat was certain. So some, you know, may have been shot in the back, but I haven't seen any confirmation that these kinds of things happened.
I'd like to hear from each of you on the point about sacrifice, because that seems to run through a fair amount of history in the region. Muin, perhaps you'd speak to it first.
Yeah, I don't think it's really unique either to Islam or the Arab world or the Middle East. I mean, you know, as Steve was mentioning, throughout history, we've actually seen this kind of thing all over the world. I mean, you had, you know, just in recent history, the Spanish Civil War, where, you know, large numbers of people went to fight in a cause which others would say was not theirs, nor in a country that was theirs, out of identification with a very secular ideology. More recently, of course, you had the anti-Soviet jihad in Afghanistan, where, you know, thousands of people from the Arab and wider Islamic worlds went to northwest Pakistan and Afghanistan itself, this time motivated by specifically Islamic cause. So the idea of sacrificing, you know, for a cause with which people very passionately identify is I think there throughout history, really, and throughout different cultures, and really not unique to this situation or region.
Steve, a quick additional comment before we take a break.
Muhammad Atta, the ringleader of the September 11th attackers, left an interesting document, and I'll just note, and perhaps we can come back to this, that he talked in terms of sacrifice in almost very kind of technical, liturgical terms. And one of the interesting things is that the sacrifice works two ways. On the one hand, one has to sacrifice oneself because as a Muslim, one has let non-Muslims take advantage of your community, and there has to be a certain self-sacrifice to expiate that sin. And on the other hand, one has to sacrifice the enemy as well, in another sense.
We're talking about Arab and Muslim volunteers to the war in Iraq this hour. Connection listeners, tell us what you think motivates these fighters. 1-800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. Joining us this hour is Muin Rabbani. He is a Middle East analyst based in Amman, Jordan. And also with us is Stephen Simon, who is a senior analyst for the RAND Corporation. We're talking about an old and new phenomenon in the Muslim world, volunteers who leave their home countries to fight against what they see as colonialist invasion to other Muslim countries. The most recent example, of course, is the Muslim volunteers to the war in Iraq. And I'd be interested in hearing from both of you on the point about this perceived need to act as an individual. I'm wondering how much that has to do with a sense of perhaps deep disappointment in their governments in terms of their not being able to stop the arrival of U.S. troops in Iraq, or even the continuation of U.S. forces in places like Saudi Arabia. Stephen, you start?
I think there is a relationship there. But let me say that Muslim tradition differentiates between different kinds of wars. And so, for example, offensive wars, those that are waged to expand the borders of the lands of Islam, impose a collective responsibility on the community. And this community can, this responsibility can be met by the community in a number of ways. But it doesn't require each individual to participate in the jihad to expand the realm of Islam. On the other hand, defensive wars are different. If there are encroachments into the realm of Islam, which is clearly how many Muslims see what's going on now in the Middle East and elsewhere, then the law is different. Then it is actually incumbent upon each and every Muslim to do his or her best to repel the invader. So there's a doctrinal basis to this view that the responsibility is individual rather than corporate. At the same time, there is a real anger among these people towards their own governments, whom they feel are not meeting the collective responsibility of Islam, of Arabs and Muslims in particular, to repel the invader. In fact, many feel that their governments are in league with the invader, that they have established a pact with the aggressor, and therefore they themselves, that is, these governments, deserve to be overthrown, that in some fundamental way, these governments are un-Islamic and are in fact, apostate.
Is that the way you see it as well, Muin? I mean, we did see an example this morning of the Yemeni intelligence forces meeting these folks at the airport and promptly throwing them into jail.
Well, quite clearly, I think most of these people who did go to Iraq would have rather gone there as members of their own national armies. And the very fact that they had to go there as individuals or small groups, I think clearly reveals a sense of disappointment with the policies pursued by their own national governments. And, you know, while taking into account all the religious or these kinds of, you know, dogmatic and theological factors, while I certainly wouldn't minimize those, I do think that this phenomenon, you know, goes way beyond Islamic theology. I think it also has to do with the realities in the region, the strong sense of national identification that you have here, the growing sense of rage and fury at the West because of what's been happening in this region over, you know, the past period. And just to give one example, to the west of here instead of to the east of here, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, where, you know, because the borders are very effectively sealed, less than half a handful of people have been able to go to either the West Bank or the Gaza Strip to support the Palestinians there. And I think also, you know, the extreme hostility to Western policies in this region. So, therefore, I think Iraq gave people an opportunity which they'd long been waiting for, really, to make the political the personal, or the personal the political. And I think it really should be understood in that much broader context rather than a narrow and uniquely Islamic one.
Let's give some of our listeners an opportunity to get in on the conversation. We'll go now to Amherst, New York, where John is phoning in. Hi, John.
Hi, folks. I guess all in all, Islam is kind of a mess. You know, prior to the war, we heard the same old tirade about intervening in the Middle East, where if the United States were to intervene, the masses would rise up and it would be like a slam on Islam and all this stuff. Well, that didn't happen. Today we're having a discussion about hundreds, if maybe thousands. I don't care if there are 10, 20, 30,000 of people who would be willing to throw their lives down, whether by suicide bomb or actually be taking up a rifle. That is an insignificant number when you look at the 1 billion Muslims that there are actually out there. So it's really kind of Islam's problems all are within. They're all willing, and it's really strange that the whole culture is virtually willing to be subjugated to either monarchies or tyrants or dictators. And it's all about religion. And they have their masses so enraged that their religion, and they're willing to throw their lives down in the name of religion, where, you know, we Christians and Jews, I mean, we just look at life so different. So for anyone to be able to judge these people for actually what they are and what they do, please, don't call me prejudiced or anything. These people have problems, and it all stems from a very distorted view of their religion, which is pandered, by the way, by state-run media, which, you know, kind of props himself up.
Okay, John, we take your point. Let's see if we can get some answers to the several questions that you've posed. Muin, can I throw that to you first?
Well, I do think that's a very distorted image of both the region and its people and, you know, the problems of this region. But just maybe one point, you know, in terms of the reaction, there were a lot of, I think, patently false alarmist predictions that, you know, 10 minutes after the first cruise missile slams into Baghdad, people are going to rise up in the streets of Cairo and Riyadh and overthrow their governments. And it doesn't work that way. You know, if you look at really the traumatic conflicts this region has experienced, whether in 1948 or 1967 or in 1991 or whatever, I mean, the reaction is not instantaneous. And if, you know, like many experts, you accept that what happened on September 11th and prior to that, the bombings of the U.S. embassies in East Africa was a reaction more to the 1991 Gulf War than to any of these other conflicts, like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or whatever, then, you know, it took more than the better part of a decade for cause and effect to manifest itself. So I fully agree that, you know, predictions that on the second day of the war governments would start being overthrown is false, but that doesn't mean that it's going to be without repercussions in this region.
So basically the fact that it hasn't happened yet doesn't necessarily mean that it's not going to happen at all. Stephen, what's your take? I'm sorry, go ahead, Muin, if you had a comment.
No, I was going to say also, if you look, you know, previously in 1948, for example, you know, when the repercussions of that got around, what you had was a series of military coups and revolutions, which went on really until the 1960s and didn't really start until well after, with one exception, until well after the conflict ended. So I don't think, you know, we should say there wasn't an instantaneous repercussion and therefore this conflict will be without consequence.
Stephen, I want to hear from you on this as well, and particularly why this is happening.
There's a Jordanian journalist, Rami Khoury, who had a very good quip, which was that the issue is not the Arab street. The issue is the Arab basement. And what he meant by that metaphor was that there wouldn't necessarily be uprisings in the street, you know, massive demonstrations, very overt things, but that changes would be taking place in a subterranean way, so to speak, which would erupt at some point. But in the meantime, they're brewing out of sight. I myself wouldn't take heart because there haven't been the sorts of massive demonstrations that some may have predicted. Now, as far as why this is happening, there's a fundamental question of who controls the language of Islam. And let me explain in as briefly as I can why this is an important question. Other avenues for the expression of political grievances have basically been closed off in many of these countries. And there is only one place in which these grievances can be expressed, and that's in the mosque. And there is only one language in which they can be expressed, and that's the language of religion. Now, because control over the language of Islam is now up for grabs because the old establishments, the old clerical hierarchies, no longer have the power that they do. And
the power or the influence, Stephen?
Well, you know, there's a fine line between the two. I mean, that's a good question, but influence gives power and power gives influence. There's a reciprocal relationship there. And you know, if you have a clerical establishment that can say, okay, this is what the Quran says, and this is what it means. We're telling you what it means. And people believe them, because after all, they're the clerical hierarchy. They are to be believed. Then the clerics, especially in combination with the power of the state, can shape people's views and really control the popular understanding of religious doctrine. When the power of the clerics has declined because they simply no longer have the credibility, in part because of increasing literacy in the Arab and Muslim world, so that people can read for themselves what they want to read and believe what they wish to believe, because after all, what they read determines what they believe, and to some extent vice versa, then, you know, why listen to the clerics? You can make up your own mind. A similar thing happened in Christianity with the advent of Protestantism, where the ability to read and understand scripture became widely dispersed once literacy started to grow. And that deprived the clergy of much of their power and influence at the time. So therefore, nowadays, you can get an electrical engineer in Cairo writing a pamphlet saying that jihad is the forgotten obligation. It's actually one of the things that should be a pillar of Islam, but has been ignored, and encourage discontented, angry, alienated youths to take jihad as their banner and as their cause.
Stephen, let's see what Mu'in has to say about all of this.
Yeah, I'd maybe give a slightly different emphasis, in which what I think you've seen happening in the Arab world over the past half century is, on the one hand, as opposed to, let's say, the secularization of society that you had in the West in the past few centuries, what you've had here is really, I mean, to put it very crudely, the extermination of political parties. We had a fairly vibrant structure of political parties throughout the region, and, you know, certainly the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. And as you've gotten these dictatorial, repressive states throughout the regions, that whole arena of political life has basically been eliminated. At the same time, in terms of the traditional clerical leadership, they've been totally subordinated by the state, and therefore lost both their power and influence, and perhaps most importantly, their credibility, because they're, you know, every day giving contradictory opinions to justify whatever the latest policy of the state is. And so, indeed, really the only vestige of political expression, or even political freedom, if you want to call it that, that's been left has been the mosque, the popular mosques, which have been taken over by the types of more militant clerics who do have credibility among large parts of the population and who preach these kinds of jihadist ideologies.
You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Let's get some of our callers in on the conversation again. Let's turn to Howard, who's phoning in from Randolph, Massachusetts. Hello, Howard.
Hi. I would like to, excuse me, I had two ideas I'd like to mention and ask your guests to comment on them. It seems to me that this action from these folks going from the Arab and Muslim world to fight the infidels, that is us, gives us an enormous amount of information about the Arab and Muslim worlds. First of all, it tells us, I think, that there's more hatred for the U.S. than there is concern for their Muslim brothers who have been tortured and oppressed for 20 years. Second, these people, the people in the street, the people we see running around with guns and explosives and so on, they seem to have no trouble smuggling that stuff into Israel to blow up, you know, innocent children. Yet when it comes to blowing themselves up in front of maybe one of Saddam Hussein's palaces or walking into one of his, you know, police stations, then all of a sudden they seem unable to fire the ammunition and the explosives. I'd like to ask your guests if this is an unfair comment to make, or if it's been covered already and I just wasn't listening or whatever, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, thanks for the call, Howard. Stephen?
Well, let me say something about those who were tortured and oppressed in places like Iraq and how many people in the region view that horrible thing. They see the U.S. as being behind the regimes that torture and oppress their own people. And it's very important to understand, it seems to me, the link in the popular imagination between their own oppressive governments and the United States. It used to be that they, the jihadists, the militants, focused on their own governments as the enemy. This was very true in Egypt and in other places in the region. Bin Laden changed that by saying it's no longer appropriate to focus on the near enemy because they're basically just puppets. It's the far enemy who's the key enemy, and that's the United States. That's how bin Laden globalized the agenda of jihad. So I think we need to bear that in mind. As far as, you know, there being, you know, more activity, you know, suicide bombings and so on in Israel against Israelis and not against Iraqis has to do with the fact that, you know, the intifada there has been going on for a number of years. There's plenty of material available as oppressive as the Israeli state can be in countering Palestinian nationalism. It's still, you know, not a totalitarian state in the way that Iraq was.
Connection listeners, we're talking about non-Iraqi volunteer fighters in the war in Iraq. Are they a marginal group or a revealing phenomenon about the mood in the Middle East? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about volunteers from Muslim countries to fight coalition forces in Iraq. And with us today is Middle East analyst Muin Rabbani, who joins us from Amman, Jordan, and also Stephen Simon, who is a senior analyst for the RAND Corporation. Gentlemen, I want to ask you both to look ahead a little bit. We have heard warnings from Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak, among others, about this. How much do you feel the Iraq war is likely to become a rallying cry for the next generation of al-Qaeda terrorists? Muin, perhaps you'd like to start.
Well, I think it depends how what happens with al-Qaeda. I mean, there's been all kinds of talk and analysis that suggests that it's becoming a spent force. I'm not in a position to assess that, but what I do think is true is that you will indeed, that this war has significantly increased the level of resentment against, certainly against the U.S. in this part of the world, and will lead to coalescing of new and perhaps more extreme forces. When you talk specifically about al-Qaeda, it may well be that you know, it being kind of in the crosshairs for so long that people may seek to avoid that and seek to find alternative structures, which may turn out to be no less lethal. So I think it's more, you know, in responding to your question, I would look more at the phenomenon than the specific organization.
What do you mean in terms of alternative sources? Alternative organizations, alternative terrorist groups,
Alternative organizations. In other words, it's not clear to me that the effect of this, to the extent that it does lead to radicalization and a willingness to join these type of extremist organizations, that people will necessarily flood to al-Qaeda, which has now not only lost its territorial base, but is being pursued around the world, around the clock, and that people may well seek to establish or perhaps expand new or existing forces other than specifically al-Qaeda, which will, you know, may well have the same aims. The other question that I think still needs to be answered is whether the effect of this will be to lead to an increase of hostility and action against the U.S., as we saw with Al-Qaeda, or whether people now will reorder their priorities to focus on their own governments.
Hmm. Stephen, I'd be interested in hearing from you on this, and also how you perceive these groups and these new faces. Might they be even more dangerous to the United States?
Yeah. Look, Al-Qaeda, as it existed, as the group that brought about September 11th and bombed embassies in Africa and so forth, that old guard may be on its way out. We don't know. About half of the, upper mid-level managers who could turn the crank on operations and make things happen because they had access to money and they knew who the contacts were and the sleeper cells and so forth. That group it was certainly under a lot of pressure, and it may be on its way out. But I'm not sure that really matters, even though they were incredibly effective while they existed and were free to act in the pre-9/11 environment. Because the movement has been globalized. It's a global ideology. In that sense, Al-Qaeda as the group has fulfilled its mission by creating a culture of jihad, which one sees from Indonesia to Uzbekistan to Afghanistan, Yemen, and East Africa. In fact, one sees it in Europe and the United States as well, in some corners of the Muslim communities in those places. So Al-Qaeda has done its work, and it now exists as a state of mind, and it's a very powerful state of mind. Secondly, Al-Qaeda has always been a network of networks. So, the networks with which it networked are still there. And will seek to operate. Their anger against the United States, and Moin is completely right about this, is probably going to increase. The first Gulf War is really what started Al-Qaeda and got it going and fed the apocalyptic visions that animated Al-Qaeda violence.
Stephen, let's hear from Amir now. He's calling in from Buffalo, New York. Amir? Hi, what's your question or comment?
The thing that I wanted to address is that in the thoughts of the structure, the power structure of this country, of America, fundamental Islam, or the Islam which holds to the fundamentals, is a big threat. And in order to address that threat, a lot of effort has been made. And most recently, as a Muslim, what I've picked up in Iraq and in Afghanistan, efforts have been made to introduce the educational system that we see here in America as a favor to those people, as a favor to the people of the Muslim world, or a favor to the people of Iraq. And more recently, I've heard comments that democracy, although it's held to be the absolute best way of ruling people, is not fit for Muslim countries, which might have fundamental Islamic parties come to power if they were to actually have elections.
Okay. Amir, do you have a question there or just wanted to make the comment?
Actually, that comment, but how that's perceived by Muslims in that part of the world is definitely as a threat toward their values, their beliefs, and their realities. And so this is a reason that as Muslims, we have to struggle against. I mean, we have to work against that. And so this has to be part of the conversation, because we get a lot of ideas from our media here that really don't that really don't address the real issues that Islam, as a way of thinking, is presenting, toward Muslims from its roots, not just came up today, but with time, Islam has to deal with the issues that are facing it.
Okay, thanks, Amir. We appreciate the call. Moin, what's your reaction?
I'm not really sure I understood all the comments, but, if we talk in terms of democracy, The available polling that's been done suggests that there is, you know, an even higher degree of support for democratic political life in this region of the world than in the United States. And, you know, it's not really surprising why. People here don't have it. They desperately want political freedoms, whereas in the United States, maybe people have learned to take it for granted or have, you know, been able to see its failures as well. That said, there's also, I think, a very high proportion of people that feel actually that the U.S., and certainly through its support to local governments in this region, as Stephen was pointing out earlier, are the biggest obstacles to democracy. So I don't think that we're here dealing with a kind of unique political culture that's incompatible with that, you know, that's either existing or desired in much of the rest of the world.
But is it a mistake for people in the United States to assume that only American-style democracy will work? I mean, in fact, shouldn't that be up to the people in the countries who have an opportunity to develop their own institutions that may not mirror the way it's done in America, but works just fine for where they are?
Well, certainly that. And secondly, the idea that, you know, the democracy can be imposed on the back of a cruise missile. And I think that helps explain the very widespread, practically universal opposition to the war in Iraq among people in the region, and even, I would say, even most particularly among many of the most democratic forces in this part of the world. So certainly, you know, one shouldn't immediately conclude that, you know, because people do want democracy, that they therefore somehow support U.S. policy in this region. I think that that would be a false conclusion to draw.
All right. Let's hear from another caller. We're going now to Marinette, Wisconsin, where Jim is phoning in. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I really appreciate this program. I've been learning as much as I can, and I've been studying for a few years now the political and religious history of the area. I don't have very much knowledge, and I'd like you to confirm some of my ideas. My understanding is that the vast majority of Muslims have very strong personal beliefs that they themselves, not necessarily their clergy, but they themselves must be righteous people, and they have historically been disappointed by their leaders, whether we're talking about the Abbasids, whether we're talking about the Ottomans, whether we're talking about the modern secular powers that are there, or whether we're talking about the imposed colonial powers that there were there in the 18th and 19th centuries, that they have a skepticism of both secular government and Western imposed governments, as well as political leadership, that makes them want to look to, you know, desperate at this point. I'm sure many of them that feel like they have no outlet other than through their religious personal actions, which would lead them, I would think, to think of extreme personal and very loosely organized individual acts of violence.
Jim, I thank you so much for the call. It certainly sounds to me as if you've been doing your homework. Thanks again for calling in. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Stephen, what do you make of Jim's comments?
Well, on the use of religion, I think we have to return to the fact that people in these countries where there have been authoritarian governments and are authoritarian governments have had little alternative but to use the language of religion to express their grievances and their dissatisfaction with existing political, social, and economic conditions. They're not free to do otherwise, and this does take place in the mosques, and it takes place in unregulated mosques. Now, the key thing is that even if the underlying complaint is social, economic, or political, once it's been expressed in religious terms, it tends to become understood in religious terms. And therein lies a problem, because religious issues can't be resolved via negotiation, or at least it's very difficult to do so, because how do you negotiate the matter of God's will? You really can't. So when things do get turned into religious issues because the underlying secular problems have to be expressed in that way, we've got a problem. Now, let me just add that, first, there is a thirst for democracy in the region, and many people in the region understand perfectly well what democracy is. Secondly, even among the radicals, there was an interesting sermon a couple of weeks ago by a very fiery Saudi preacher, Salman Al-Auda, who was a big backer of the jihad, but is now saying, well, look, okay, we've had our explosion in the form of September 11th. Now we need to apply our religious reasoning to search for more constructive paths to follow. And he seemed to be advocating a kind of pluralist approach to politics. And so, you know, there are interesting things going on within the Islamic community that counter this tendency towards, you know, jihad as the answer to everything.
Stephen, I have to stop you there. Thank you. Actually, you stopped yourself. I need a quick last word, if I can get one, Muin, about to this point, whether if the United States is able to leave Iraq pretty quickly, will that help diffuse some of the Arab anger, and particularly by this younger generation of fighters, or is it already too late?
It may well already be too late, but obviously there is much that the U.S. could do to lessen the damage that, in my view, has already been done. And certainly one of those would be leaving Iraq as soon as possible, or at least handing over the administration to Iraq to the U.N. or some kind of international supervision, in addition to other issues, you know, such as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. We thank you so much, Steve Simon. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be here.
Steve is a senior analyst for the RAND Institute and co-editor of Iraq at the Crossroads, State and Society in the Shadow of Regime Change. And Muin Rabbani, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Muin is a Middle East analyst currently working in Amman, Jordan. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection.